In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
If you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, I'll warn you right up front, today's show is not for you. In fact, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, today's show probably ought to come with one of those dire warnings they give for prescription drugs. If you suffer from Sanders socialism syndrome, today's show may cause your eyes to glaze over or sudden trance-like conditions. It may cause excessive vomiting. Do not listen to today's show while driving, as Sanders socialism syndrome sufferers have been known to suddenly take both hands off the wheel to shove their fingers in their ears. On rare occasions, Sanders socialism syndrome sufferers have been known to actually learn something. Yes, on today's show, we'll be talking about the E-word, and I know that Bernie Sanders voters don't like to think about the E-word. On today's show, it's about 50 test tubes of competition and democracy and how states' economic choices, there's that E-word, impact the businesses within their states and, of course, the people in them. Policy decisions never exist in a vacuum. They always have real-life consequences. Take, for example, this whole push to double the minimum wage. If you think that kind of decision exists in a vacuum, that it won't have any consequences, that it won't have any impacts, then why not just double your prices instead? Economics is a study of action and reactions. It's not just numbers. You cannot just raise the minimum wage without it having an impact. Just like if there's a hole in the state budget, you cannot just simply raise taxes without that having an impact. Here in the U.S., we have 50 test tubes of competition and democracy, the states. On today's show, we'll be talking about the different policy decisions that states make that impact their competitiveness, meaning their ability to attract new businesses or citizens. These decisions impact not only the competitiveness of the states, but the financial well-being of those citizens, which impacts the state budgets. So thanks for joining us today on the iSpy Radio Show. We'll try not to use the E-word too much, but I can't guarantee it. You have been warned. And I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He is co-author, along with Stephen Moore and Arthur B. Laffer, of Rich States, Poor States. Jonathan, it is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thanks so much for having me back on the show, my friend.
This is the 8th edition. You guys always make this an interesting read. I suppose this is not the average coffee table type of reading for most people, but it's always a fascinating dissection, really, of what's going on with the states. And why don't you talk to us a little bit about the goal of Rich States, Poor States?
Well, yeah, that we've been conducting this research for 8 years now, as you said, which is hard to believe. We put together this project during my first month on the job here at ALEC as director of the Tax and Fiscal Policy Department. And we wanted to have a guide for legislators as well as business leaders and the general public to really have a barometer to say, how is my state doing versus the other 49, realizing that we have these 50 laboratories of democracy, as Justice Brandeis famously put it, and that they're all competing with each other and against each other in some cases for jobs, capital, Americans who migrate from state to state, and what are the policies that matter for growth across the states? And those are the really sort of big questions that we wanted to answer through the Rich States, Poor States project that started 8 years ago.
We sometimes will have you on, and we just suddenly it gets into like segment two or three, and we realize, oh, you know, we didn't even actually introduce what ALEC is, and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about what ALEC does and just exactly how evil of an organization it is.
Well, first of all, you know, we're not Alec Baldwin. Sometimes we get confused, but we are the American Legislative Exchange Council, and it's America's largest nonpartisan membership organization for individual legislators. And so we have about 25% of all of America's state legislators are members of ALEC. We're different from some of the other groups out there in that, A, we don't take taxpayer support through state appropriations, such as many of the other legislative organizations do.
And which also, of course, means that you don't have that conflict of interest either.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's important for our philosophy as well, as that our philosophy is governed by the ideas of free markets, limited government, and federalism. And that's also another thing that differentiates us from some of the other groups out there. But we've been around for more than 40 years now. We are really a resource, a legislator's think tank in many cases, producing things like Rich States, Poor States to help educate America's state legislators on critical economic policy issues that are facing them. And one thing that many casual observers don't realize is that state legislators don't have, in many cases, full-time staff, or if they do, they have to share those full-time staff with other state legislators. So it's much different than members of Congress who are very well-staffed with research staff to be able to take care of their constituents' needs. ALEC really fills the gap for those legislators that believe in our principles, that believe in free exchange of ideas.
Well, and a prime example of that, you mentioned the fact that a lot of state representatives and senators just don't have the staffing. And a prime example of that is here in Oregon, where we have a so-called part-time legislature. They only meet for a few months, and then they go home. But when you go into those offices, they've got a helper, and usually it's their spouse. And that's it for their staffing. And so you guys really do fill a very important role for a lot of these guys that they come into the Capitol, and they're just overwhelmed with all of these bills that get thrown at them in terms of trying to understand policy and everything else. And I always tease you guys about being an evil organization, because the big government organizations that are out there pushing social reforms or pushing more spending and more taxes and we just got to grow government, they just absolutely loathe you guys. And even out here in some of the rural areas, I've actually seen two signs that talk about how evil ALEC is. It's almost laughable to see those.
Well, as one of my good friends has put it, Senate President Wayne Niederhauser in Utah, if you like free markets, if you like limited government, and if you like federalism, you're going to love ALEC. If you hate those principles, you're going to hate ALEC.
That's right.
And unfortunately, it comes down very clearly to those lines sometimes, that those who believe in bigger government, more taxes, and more federal government control over our lives are not eager that ALEC is going out and spreading the message on the opposing side of what they're looking to do.
That's right. And, I was thinking about this as we're getting prepped for the show. It's almost sad in a way that ALEC even needs to exist. I mean, you would think that our government would want to be fiscally responsible, that it would want to improve its services, such as education, that it would want to reduce regulations and make it easier for businesses to sprout up and grow. But, I guess it's that eternal struggle, isn't it? The government wants to grow, and we the people have to keep finding ways to shove it back into its bottle. But it really does bring up a larger point, which is, why do you suppose it is that the government only ever wants to build on what it's done rather than discontinuing an obviously failing program or department and just starting over from scratch?
Well, and Mark, if I ever ran for office, which I don't think I will, one of my platforms will be, I elect me to repeal a lot of bad laws, right, instead of create new laws. And I think that's a big difference, unfortunately, that many elected officials come in to say, to show that I'm quote-unquote doing something, I need to pass new things, new rules, new regulations, and new laws. And in many cases, we just need to take a comprehensive look at the existing structure of things to see what's needed, what's not needed, and just do a nice spring cleaning when it comes to reducing and eliminating, in some cases, laws and government programs.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead and take a break right there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the state of the states, including the drivers of success and also the road to ruin, the drivers of failure. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, helping you to keep an eye on big government, and to do that, probably no better organization out there than ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, and we're pleased to have Jonathan Williams with us. And he is one of the authors of Rich States, Poor States, their annual report on the performance of the state economic outlooks. And before we get in there, though, we often hear that we should run government like a business. What would you guys change about government if we let me say that a different way. What would change about government if we decided to run it more like a business?
Well, I think, first of all, the easy answer, I guess the big picture answer, is there has to be a decision between needs and wants that are made. You know, many times when it comes to government, the idea is you don't need to choose between needs and wants because you can even always go back to the taxpayers and just charge them the extra difference, right, when you don't balance your budget. And of course, it's worse than that at the federal level. We don't even have a balanced budget requirement. You can just print your way out of the problem with quantitative easing and whatnot as well on the monetary policy side. So at the state level, though, it's just the discussion many times does not happen as to, is this something that's needed or is this something that's wanted? So getting back to kind of the business side of budgeting or the family, the kitchen table sort of budgeting is that those discussions happen each and every day, right? Where in government, you always have the option to say, we don't want to take those tough decisions on the spending reduction side or prioritization. We're just going to go back and bill the taxpayers for the extra that we overspent.
Well, and of course, the other aspect of that, too, is that businesses run based on what they earn versus states which use kind of a forward-looking budget in the sense that they think that they will make this amount of money and then they try to budget that accordingly. You know, businesses kind of look at their past performance rather than just kind of willy-nilly going out there and throwing budgets into the air. And it's always growth. The budget always grows. You never see anybody going in there and saying, okay, well, actually, an even better way to look at it is perhaps, as you say, you know, from a policy standpoint, let's reward the really good performing agencies and departments that they didn't spend 100% of their budget. But instead, right now, the way that it goes is if you spend 100%, well, guess what? You get a raise in your budget next year.
That's right. And if you're conservative, if you're frugal and you don't spend everything, you get it taken away, right?
Because
clearly
right.
You didn't need it, right?
So, and that's the exact opposite of what a business would do.
Yeah, it's basically the concept of having a performance or priority-based budget, and that's really the big difference, I think. And obviously, your point is a good point on government forecasts, because obviously they can be manipulated, and they many times are manipulated for political purposes to try to manipulate what's going to happen at the next legislative cycle.
That's right. So, of course, one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on was the recent release of ALEC's annual report, Rich States, Poor States. And what exactly are some of the drivers of economic success when it comes to the states that you guys normally look at?
So for Rich States, Poor States, we have 15 equally weighted factors that we use as our really tool to look at and analyze how a state's doing in economic competitiveness. And looking at these 15 factors, everything from tax rates, labor policy, regulation, and overall basically business climate health of a state. And I think that these are all proven to be important factors when you look at not just the anecdotal evidence, but looking at the academic evidence over time as reasons why, for instance, businesses move from one state to another, or reasons why individuals pack up and vote with their feet and go from one state to another. And things like income taxes are a big reason why people will go from one state to another. Things like right-to-work status, things like labor costs, costs of electricity, everything that's an input cost to a business to be successful in a state and hire individuals and be productive and produce things that people want to consume. These are all things that we think are very important for overall economic outlook of a state, and that's how we rank the states in our book.
So let's back up a little bit, because we mentioned the fact that a lot of these representatives, when they come into the building, they don't have big staff, and maybe they don't have a lot of experience, maybe they don't have a lot of business experience. You know, for whatever reason, they get themselves elected. And here they are, they're faced with all these wants and needs of the government, and so they're looking at the budget and this ever-expanding education budget. And, you know, we just need more money for the schools. And so the natural reaction of maybe someone in that is, well, we need more money, therefore we have to raise taxes. Why is that a bad idea?
Well, there's a few reasons on that. Obviously, the first is the big difference in budgeting as well as private sector versus the government is you look at inputs in the government budgeting many times, and you look at outcomes when you look at private sector budgeting many times, right? So education spending is an input, and many times that's all people look at to say, well, are you increasing your input by increasing more K-12 education spending, and that's an inherent good, instead of saying, well, is increased education spending getting us any better outcomes and results for student achievement? And that's a question that many times is not asked, that needs to be asked before you even talk about anything on the tax side. But then certainly when it comes to raising taxes, you have the whole issue of not being able to raise taxes in a vacuum, right? So everything that Oregon does or another state does to raise taxes immediately raises the price of living, working, and doing business within the borders of your state. having that dynamic effect, and what we see of people and individuals and capital moving across the 50 states, that has an immediate consequence. So it's not cost-free to say we're going to raise taxes to pay for something new. You're going to see an immediate decline in your competitiveness.
That's right. And it's kind of like if you have two stores on either side of the road, and one has a 50% off sale and the other one says, we're going to raise all of the prices by 25%, which store are people going to go to?
Yeah, that, it's not rocket surgery, as Art Laffer would say. And actually, with an example, one year we talked about, there was actually, in the Midwest, there's a chain of gas station convenience stores called Quick Trip. And there was actually, at one point in time, a Quick Trip store located right on the Kansas-Missouri state line, believe it or not. The state line went right through the property of the store. And so they actually were looking at the taxes on both sides of the equation, realized that Missouri has much lower gasoline taxes, much lower cigarette taxes, and were figuring out that it made sense for them business-wise to close down for 8 months, completely demolish their facility, move exclusively on the Missouri side of the line just to save on that kind of a tax.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. All right, we are coming up on a break. Let's go ahead and do that right now. Coming up, we're going to continue to look at what makes states successful. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We are talking today to Jonathan Williams of ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Their website, if you'd like to go visit that, is alec.org. And, of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And while you're there, check out the links to their publication, Rich States, Poor States. It's available as a PDF. Makes it really easy to just download, and you can do searches for different keywords and whatnot. And really fascinating read. I highly recommend that you download that and then send it off to your state legislators. They really need it. So Jonathan, we were talking about some of the drivers of success. And, you know, if you guys had to pick just one policy that is a 100% lock to improve a state's economic performance, that you could say, look, if you do nothing else, do this one policy, what would you say that would be?
Boy, that is a good question. And, you know, if politics was not an obstacle, since it's obviously a heavy lift, I would shoot for the moon and say eliminate your income tax and go to some other form of taxation to fund core priorities of government. Because you look at the experience of the states across not just the last 10 years, but across the last 50 or 60 years that we have reliable data. And the vast preponderance of the evidence suggests that having a no income tax status on the personal side and business side as well, if you could, is a huge boost to economic stimulus for the states that avoid income taxes. Today, of course, we have 9 that do not tax personal income at the state level. Of course, Oregon is not one of those. Oregon's taking the other approach, which is don't tax sales, but tax income at a very, very high rate. But you look at the 9 states without personal income taxes over this last decade, vastly outperformed their high tax counterparts, whether you're looking at population, income growth, wage growth, or overall GDP growth, or even tax revenue growth. Those states are seeing that economic premium from not having an income tax. And by the way, go back 50 years, all the states that have adopted an income tax over that time period, there's been 11 that have, all of them have fallen in terms of their economic vitality relative to the rest of the country over that time period. It's just a very interesting correlation of what's happened over 50 years now.
Wow, that's interesting. So last year's edition, that was written in the wake of the 2014 election, which saw a lot of Republican victories at the state level. And one of the surprises, really, in last year's edition of Rich States, Poor States was that a lot of traditional liberal states, the blue states, were adopting sound fiscal reforms instead of the traditional liberal policies of tax and spend. Those states included Wisconsin, New Mexico, Michigan, New Jersey, Maryland, Rhode Island, and Illinois, and even a little bit of movement there as far as New York State is concerned, even though they didn't shift red. So how have those states fared, just kind of generally speaking?
Well, generally speaking, that group of states has been a group of states that suffered dramatically over the last decade or two because of the huge population outflows, the huge business outflows of people looking for more economic opportunity in places like Texas and Florida and many of the places that have been magnets for growth. But I think as part of that experience, you know, the silver lining of that experience is many of those states are now starting to figure out that if we don't do something to keep people here and give people a reason to stay other than that they have family here or they have nostalgia here to this city or this state. We've got to get our act together. And if you need any more evidence on that, take a look back 2 weeks, what happened in New York or in Connecticut and Massachusetts with General Electric, right? I mean, this is the cash cow for Connecticut, who now has let that golden goose fly away and lay its golden eggs in another state, in Boston of all places, because of the tax climate. If it could happen with General Electric, with a major company like that picking up its roots and moving its headquarters and all the good high-paying jobs to a place like Boston, it can happen anywhere. And I think these states have realized over time and over decades now of out-migration of people and dollars that they need to start doing something right. And when you see even New York, even Maryland, even Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia has voted in the last year to cut marginal income tax rates. There's something really happening even among the liberal high tax states today.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. That is one of the segments here within Rich States, Poor States, is this notion of America on the move and analyzing Americans that are, you know, this is kind of what's known as voting with your feet. And I remember a long time ago, our very first year, in fact, I had interviewed somebody from a more liberal economic business alliance here in Oregon, SEDCOR. That's the Strategic Economic Development Corp. It's based here, I think, here in Salem, really. And he said something that I just was kind of flabbergasted over. I couldn't even respond to it. And he says, when I mentioned this notion that, you know, if you raise taxes here, then people will leave and businesses will leave. And he says, oh, that doesn't happen. Brick and mortar businesses just don't pack up and leave, which, of course, is a total lie, as you just said, you know, with General Electric. But, I mean, we see it all the time. Our entire history, it's filled with examples of people moving for economic reasons. Our country was founded on this. People braved months on the open seas to vote with their feet from the old country. The Oregon Trail is another example. The California Gold Rush. So why is it that states that perform poorly assume that people will not move to better performing states?
I think that's just what they tell themselves to try to make their bad economic policies seem more palatable to their constituents. They try to say that nothing will happen, people won't leave, and it's just a flat-out lie, like you said. I mean, if you need any more evidence, yeah, I think we're going to be talking about this General Electric move for many, many years, and that Connecticut was warned many times that if they kept going down this road of higher taxes and targeting the business community for more and more revenue, they were going to lose General Electric and possibly some other very large companies, and they continue to go down that road, and now they, of course, are seeing the consequences. But this is not an isolated example. And,
no,
you know, we've
no.
talked about this for many, many years in Rich States, Poor States. California has been one of the huge net losers of jobs and businesses going from to states like Arizona and Utah and other very competitive states. But this is not an isolated example, and the people who deny it are just that. They're deniers of economic reality.
Well, and on a broader sense, we see that on a national level, where companies like Ford or some of these other ones, they threaten to move their plants, so you know, not just to another state, but to a whole other country.
And that's something to be very nervous about as a nation. You know, I think looking across the world to see what the trends have been on tax cuts for business taxes, especially for multinationals that are looking at many, many different jurisdictions to invest in. We are now some of the highest corporate taxes in the world in the United States. There's a reason why you've seen this trend towards the corporate inversions we've seen in the news now. Pfizer was, of course, the most recent, really, that's been talked about. But, I mean, an iconic American company like Burger King is now a Canadian company because of corporate income taxes. And there's something very wrong about that. You know, we're on the wrong side of the Laffer curve. That if we could actually reduce business taxes in the United States, I think you'd see a vast flow of capital back into the United States from other countries, because businesses do want to be here. It's just the taxes are chasing them away.
It's kind of fundamental to business is trying to make a profit. And when you take that away from them, they will leave. All right. You know, I'd like to ask you the same question we asked you in the last segment. If there is one policy that is most likely to destroy a state's performance, but we are up against the break, so we'll have to do that after this. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Jonathan Williams of ALEC, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council. They basically advise states on their economic policies, and they have their eighth edition of the Rich States, Poor States, which we'll make available on iSpyRadio.com, or you can download it off of their website, which is alec.org, A-L-E-C.org. And so, Jonathan, I was teasing the question here. If there was one policy that is most likely to destroy a state's performance, what would that be?
Well, hate to be a broken record here, so I won't say high income taxes, even though I think that's a pretty good answer. Is, you know, that will certainly drive away businesses and capital out of your state just on the reciprocal side of what we talked about. I think the other thing is being seen as an anti-business state, generally, the perception of that, I think, whether it is labor policy, whether it's the taxes, whether it's unfunded pension liabilities, having the reputation of a state that doesn't have its act together when it comes to budgets and taxes and is toxic to business, I think is the combination of all those things, you know, in a place like, whether it's Maryland or Illinois or New Jersey or New York, they suffer from a confluence of those factors that, you know, businesses, when they're looking at multi-state opportunities, just don't include those states in the bunch because just they don't have their fiscal house in order. And I think that's it's a bit of a hedge on your answer since it's a multi-prong, but I think that's really probably the worst that can be done for a state.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of this just comes down to what would we put on the marketing flyer? And, you know, what would you say in order to attract businesses? Would you say, hey, we're going to use a closet purge system so that way even private industry is going to have to pay into it and set up these retirement accounts. And we're going to force you to do that sort of thing, which is what Oregon did last year. Or we're gonna really nail you on healthcare, or you know, all these different policies. If you wouldn't advertise it, you shouldn't be doing it. I think it's that simple.
Absolutely, and you know, actually, to that point, Utah, which has been number one in rich states, poor states for all 8 years, believe it or not, they actually have come up with a state resume, a one pager that talks about all the factors that they have that they think what makes Utah a positive state to come and invest. I don't think many states would want to come up with that one page resume given their current set of policies right now. I think they'd be too embarrassed.
Yeah, well, Oregon would certainly favor fall into that. And speaking of which, what's it looking like for Oregon?
Well, I wish the news was better. Unfortunately, Oregon
let me interrupt you there. Is that, you know, I don't know how many times we've had you on exactly, but I think every time I've asked you that question, you've said that same thing.
Well, unfortunately, it keeps getting more and more true because Oregon keeps falling further and further in the rankings. In fact, this year at number 45, this ties an all-time worst that was tied back in 2012. Last year, where you had gained up to number 42, now back down to number 45, and certainly now suffering from that. And looking at a few of the reasons why you got into number 45 this year, personal and corporate income taxes, number 47 and number 48, respectively, in the country. Two of the worst things to be in the bad shape on, like we discussed earlier. Obviously, having a state-level death tax is bad for a resume, as we were discussing. And then, you know, not being a right-to-work state, having an extremely high state minimum wage, all things that complicate things greatly for potential employers.
Yeah, and the minimum wage, they're now trying to put that on the ballot, I believe. Well, certainly the governor is saying that she wants to raise rates, although kind of interesting, she wants to raise it higher in Portland than in the rural areas, but we'll have to have you back on to talk about that. So one of the things that is I found to be very interesting in this particular edition is you guys talk about tax cronyism, and to me, this is really the ruin of the free market system. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about that? What exactly is tax cronyism?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not. Tax cronyism is not real tax reform, right? And so that's really one thing to keep in mind is that many times state elected officials will say, well, we're cutting taxes by giving out special favorites to one company or one industry, and they think that that is a good conservative thing to do by cutting somebody's tax burden. We don't think that's the case. We think that obviously it's rife with cronyism, but also it's the more effective approach is to just reduce taxes across the board for everybody, let everybody play by the same rules. And we dedicate this chapter to talking about some of the best case studies and worst case studies and what states are doing on either playing by kind of the free market approach, low tax rates for everybody, versus the approach of states, let's say, like New York, which have high tax rates on everybody, that but then want to pick special favorites and winners and losers.
So basically put, tax cronyism is what other people on the other side of the aisle would say tax incentives. Where you're essentially applying and you're giving an incentive to, say, a favored industry or sometimes even a favored business itself. I mean, we certainly saw that here with Nike getting a huge tax break that nobody else qualified for. Is that just another way to put it for tax cronyism? Is it's different types of tax incentives?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's a way. I mean, a lot of times it will be viewed as economic development programs, whether it's on the cash subsidy side or whether it's a tax favoritism side of creating a special credit deduction or carve out for a particular industry or company. And these are very problematic across the states at this state and local levels of government. Of course, you get into local property tax abatements, let's say for big box retailers or things like that, that you'll find very common at the local level, tax increment financing districts, things like that. So it's A, on the subsidy side of government handouts with special funds, and then B, on the tax carve-out side.
Right. Well, you know, this just smacks of socialism. I mean, this is going back to the old Soviet days in some ways, where they have figured out, they have somehow determined it as government employees, they know where the markets are going to go, they know where they need to grow and where they don't. And we certainly see this a lot with the environmental clean energy, where they offer tax breaks or even cash for favored industries, and like I said, sometimes even favored businesses. But good luck if you're a coal-based energy company. That's not the role of government. That's the role of the market. The government should just, as you say, be offering the same rules for everybody.
Yeah, you would hope. And, you know, it's reminiscent of the old Soviet five-year plan, as
that's
you
right.
alluded
yeah.
to, right? And so the problem is that government isn't that great at picking what's in the future. I mean, government's not at the lead of innovation. You know, the lead of innovation is the private sector, right? And so government always is usually behind the curve in that case, and it's not good for state taxpayers because at the end of the day, these are state taxpayer dollars being used to benefit one company or one industry over another, and we're not even sure how it's going to pan out.
Yes, and many of which just happen to be the lobbyists that are in the building there, or maybe donors. And you know, whether you call it tax incentives or tax cronyism, it is the tax equivalent of racism, quite frankly. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the effects on the presidential candidacies and the role of the executive in all of this. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is with ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, one of the most evil and hated organizations out there if you're on the left side of the taxing and spending policy. Anyway, Jonathan is one of the co-authors of Rich States, Poor States. It is a really fantastic guide in terms of what states ought to be doing if they want to be prosperous. And, you know, we're going into the break there, we were talking about tax cronyism and all of that. And that kind of begs really a much bigger question, is do free markets even exist today?
Well, they certainly do relative in some states to others. I'll say that, you know, looking at a state like Texas or Florida or Arizona or Utah, the states that do well in rich states, poor states, they do have a much greater deal of freedom, whether it's economic freedom or generally freedom when it comes to state governance. And you look at New York, California, Maryland, Illinois, kind of on the other side of the spectrum, much, much less degree of freedom. Now, that being said, states are only as good as the federal government can be as well. Just because the federal government having so much oversight over states' autonomy and probably way too much, much more than the founders intended. And so some of that, of course, is tempered by the degree that we have economic freedom at the federal level, which, of course, I think in most viewers' minds has been on the decline over the last, at least 5 to 10 years.
Well, let's move a little bit into the role of the executive, at least in terms of the executive branch. You know, we hear about the importance of this, and it naturally is important to have a good leader at the top of things, certainly when it comes to the presidents. But in terms of the states themselves, is there a correlation of, say, Republican governors and states that are doing well versus a correlation of Democrat governors and states that are doing poorly?
Well, I think that some would like to, you know, make those probably the partisan comparisons. I do think that it's a little bit of a bigger issue than that because, you know, quite honestly, two of the bigger problems in the 2015 legislative sessions of states that are raising taxes were Nevada and Alabama, both with Republican governors.
That's right.
In fact, Nevada had probably the state's largest tax increase in history of Nevada. They were controlled completely by Republicans and both had the legislature, not free market Republicans in many cases, I will say. And their governor's plan to come out and have a gross receipts tax on business, one of the most pernicious types of business taxes, I think it's going to have grave consequences consequences on Nevada's future and economic outlook. They've been a beneficiary for so many years of California's problems, and they ought to have learned from that, but I don't think that they did. And in Alabama, Governor Bentley had something like 8 different tax increases during his State of the State last year that he proposed. So I think it's bigger than party. I think it's more of the governing ideology, basically, that is this governor going to be a free market leaning governor, a governor that does not want to engage in cronyism, that lets the lower taxes and kind of limited philosophy of government be the governing philosophy of the state, or is it going to be a governor that's going to follow kind of the tax and spend model going forward? So we've seen good examples on both sides of the equation, I think, there.
Well, and just to remind people, it wasn't that long ago that we had a fully Republican federal government as well. We had President Bush. He had a Republican-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled House, and they just did exactly what it sounds like Nevada did, where they just started spending wildly. And competition is good, and in some sense, it's good to have always that fear that you're, in this case, the Democrat rivals nipping at your heels, because you know that if you don't put in sound fiscal policies, well, guess what, the voters will vote you out.
Yeah, financial reality is not negotiable, and it's not a partisan issue either. And that, as we've talked about, New York and Maryland and places like that, D.C. has even seen the light and has started to cut taxes. Many of your listeners are familiar with Terry McAuliffe, of course, now governor of Virginia. This year, he has a proposal to reduce Virginia's corporate income tax rate to keep up with what the great tax reforms that North Carolina has enacted over the last few years. So it's a post-partisan issue. It's a issue of economic competitiveness instead.
Yeah. Well, like I said, competition is always good at pretty much every level. Makes you stronger. Has Alec done much analysis of the presidential candidate's economic plan? You know, actually, let me save that for the next segment. In terms of the governors themselves, and to a larger extent, the people running for office on the presidential level, do you see any kind of correlation in terms of the experience that they bring to the table once they get into office? For example, a business person versus somebody that's been in government all the time. And no, this is not an endorsement of Trump, but I mean, he does sort of beg the question.
Well, sir, I think there's some case studies that we can look at from the states and some of the governors. One of my favorite governors right now is Governor Doug Ducey of Arizona. And I don't know if you know the background of him. Most people don't know that he was the founder of Cold Stone Creamery. So something that I've frequented on probably far too many occasions myself. He was founder and then CEO for many years of Cold Stone before being elected to government. And I think he's one of the most innovative governors with the most ambitious free market agendas of any governor in the country. Then you have business type governors like Rick Snyder in my home state of Michigan, and also Rick Scott in a place like Florida, which have done some fantastic things on tax cuts. Michigan, of course, became a right-to-work state just several years ago, which I didn't think was humanly possible in my lifetime. And then you hear kind of the other side of the argument, which is sometimes business elected officials that come in as governors, maybe for the first time as being elected, come in with the approach that we don't have to work with the other branches of government. So that's the criticism that you'll get many times from state legislators to say, these folks are coming in as an executive. They've been an executive their whole life.
They're just used to ordering people around,
my way or the highway, and they don't seem to be quite as collaborative, and that's the criticism you hear from the legislative branch.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly not one side of the aisle or the other. We saw that with Obama when he came in, didn't have any business experience, and he did that same thing as, it's my way or the highway type of thing. Let's go ahead and take a break a little early, just because I do want to talk a little bit more about the presidential candidates and some of the sound economic policies, hopefully, that they're starting to put forward, and what your guys' analysis is. So we will do that when we come back. And we're back now into our final segment with Jonathan Williams of ALEC, that's American Legislative Exchange Council. You can check iSpyRadio.com for links to their site, as also to their latest edition, the 8th edition of The Rich States, Poor States. Really fascinating read. In fact, we're going to have Jonathan back on to talk about some of the more interesting issues there going on with Kansas as an example of all of this. I do want to talk a little bit about the presidential candidates here in our last segment. And let's say that ALEC had the ear of the candidates. What national federal programs would you guys be advising them, or in terms of economic policies, what would you guys be telling them?
Well, there's a couple of things that, I would certainly want to point out, and generally on the competitiveness side, and then secondly on the fiscal responsibility and debt side, because I think both are so important going forward if we want to keep this country as really the economic powerhouse and the leader in the world in economic affairs. And I think, first of all, you know, we had discussed it earlier a little bit on the corporate tax side. You know, it is just does not make any sense whatsoever to have the highest business taxes in the industrialized world today like we have, and we're seeing many, many American companies now become foreign companies just because of the tax purposes. They really want to be companies that are headquartered here, but it doesn't make economic sense for them to do that. And we're just chasing away jobs, we're chasing away revenue by having an uncompetitive corporate tax system. Mm. You know, secondly, it is just the way that we are handling our national debt. Looking at the U.S.
Yes.
debt clock, you know, I'm looking at $18 trillion, you know, $938 billion, $885 million currently that we have in national debt. And you work that out, debt per taxpayer, guess what that is? $158,000, over $158,000 for every taxpayer in this country.
Yeah, everybody owes. Quickly. Yeah, everybody owes a separate house to the government. It's astounding when you look at that. And that's every man, woman, and child. That's not just households.
Yeah, it's unbelievable on how much it's grown as well over the last 8 years of the Obama
yes.
administration. It is more debt's been added in the last 8 years than has been added in the previous history of the United States.
Yes.
It's just incredible to see that bad trajectory we're on debt. And then, you know, just secondly, or I guess lastly, putting it, we need to examine the programs that we are doing as a federal government. You know, why are we racking up all these bills? Are these all these various agencies needed at the federal level, or they can be devolved maybe to the states or have operations moved to the private sector? And I think those are really important questions that we don't fundamentally look at. Are these things that are needs versus wants at the federal
yes.
level?
Yeah, and that gets back to our very first segment too, in terms of, you know, why don't you start these over from scratch rather than just continuing to expand on them, and it just doesn't work. So that kind of begs the question then is, which programs or departments would you guys be advising them to get rid of?
I think you have to look really hard at things that, you know, states should be doing. You know, look at the original intent of the Constitution, look at the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, the idea of federalism, and that is those things not directly given to the federal government in the Constitution should be reserved for the states or the people of the states. And there's so many examples. I wish we had another hour show to talk about this, but let me say one is I think transportation is a no-brainer. There's no reason that this, it was the Eisenhower interstate system that we put together in the 1960, it was supposed to be done in the 1960s, and then it was supposed to be turned over to the states to maintain. There is no reason to have the kind of federal bureaucracy overseeing America's interstate highways today when the states could do it much more effectively, let them collect the gas tax dollars instead of sending it to D.C., to having the bureaucrats take a chunk out and then begging for what you can to come back to your state. That's a really easy one, I think, that can be done relatively quickly, but there's so many more.
Couple highlights of those. For example, I would certainly recommend getting rid of the EPA. I think states can certainly manage their own environmental issues. And then probably education would be another one that I'd probably axe.
Absolutely. And you look at block grants for things like health care and the Medicaid program.
Yeah.
I mean, having block grants to the states to allow them to be real laboratories of democracy and innovate and provide the best quality health care at the lowest cost that is possible instead of having this chunky, or I should say the clunky federal program when it comes to Medicaid dollars with all the strings attached. You know, we're losing federalism, we're losing state autonomy by basically states begging for their own dollars back after state taxpayers send them to Washington.
We only got about a minute here with you, and Obama, you know, you mentioned that our debt has increased by about $8 trillion under Obama. Has he backed or created any economic policy that has actually been effective?
Well, you know, for all the controversy over it, the TPA with free trade agreements, you know, it's got probably some things in the details that not everybody is going to be happy about or maybe shouldn't be happy about. But I think that this administration's commitment to trying to expand markets, trying to expand free trade has been something that they deserve some credit for. They've been so bad on so many economic policy issues when it comes to taxing and spending. But when it comes to trying to expand free trade, I think that everyone needs to at least tip their hat to say they're trying to do the right thing here in expanding markets abroad.
Yeah, well, I do like the notion of expanding markets, getting new customers for our companies. But with 96 million people still out of work, It is hard to say that that outweighs all of the failures there. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Always a pleasure.
Hey, good to be back with you.
Well, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter and you're hearing me talk right now, you either just woke up from your coma, just tuning in, or you actually made it. See, economics isn't so bad, but it's definitely not for the faint of heart either. And that's why it's important to elect politicians that actually understand this. Be sure to check iSpyRadio.com. We'll make sure that we have links up that we mentioned during today's show, including a link to the PDF form of Rich States, Poor States. Fascinating reading. I was serious when I said that in the earlier part of the show. Download it and send it to your legislator. They need this information. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much again for joining us. And as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.